can ask the speakers to join us on the stage. Chris, just before they come up, here we go.
Oh, yeah, cool.
So almost evenly split on that one. What was the other question?
I think there was one other question, if we can put that up, please.
In 5 years' time,
again, reasonably ambivalent in the thing. I mean, just picking up on the Da Vinci robot, $1 million to $3 million, each operation costs you 3,000 consumables, not a smidgen of proof that it makes any difference at all to outcomes. So is that the future? The people here and insurance companies overpaying for technology that doesn't work, that's been heavily marketed, with all due respect to your wife?
Much the same.
Who's about to give birth.
Exactly.
I hope not now.
No, pardon me. Good call out. I mean, I think for a normal prostatectomy, it's about 10 to 12K.
For no benefit.
Exactly. We'll get
colorectal surgeon,
but
no benefit.
Yep. For the Da Vinci, it's about 80 to 100,000 for the same operation. So we're talking tenfold increasing costs for no benefit, as you've said. So my view is...
So it's not cool at all.
Pardon?
It's not cool at all.
Not cool.
It's rather
uncool,
hot in terms
very, very
of
uncool, but
expense.
But,
but isn't that the way we're going to go? So, I mean, and that's what we were talking about yesterday, is that more and more expensive technology for fewer and fewer benefits, because life's more complicated than that, and new technology rarely adds a benefit.
Yeah, I think that's a good call out. I suppose in the initial phases, we actually need to start somewhere with technology. Now, the Da Vinci robot at the moment, it's huge, and it takes a number of hours, 100 hours or whatever, to train somebody in it. I think over time, these things will get cheaper and quicker to train and to actually implement. I suppose the flip side is around new and novel technology. We've actually, in some of our schemes, started getting requests for iLimbs is a term we might use, so artificial limbs, so robotic limbs that are driven by myoprocessors. So basically, you pull some nerves out from the... So somebody's had an amputation, you pull some nerves out from the neck, re-innovate the stump, and then use that stump to start moving a robotic hand. I think there's a real ethical question around that, because these things cost a lot, and as you said, can a person using a body-controlled prosthetic function just as well as somebody with an expensive robotic limb? You know, the promise in the future is that you might be able to learn to play guitar with one of these robotic limbs, etc. So I'm with you on that. I think there's a whole bunch of ethical and other financial questions we need to answer before we'll actually know where we're going.
Although that is a technology I've seen in the US Army. It is truly amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wanted, you know, underpinning each one of your comments was the future of machine learning, deep learning, artificial intelligence. So I did a story recently. So one of the leaders in artificial intelligence in health is at UTS in Sydney. And he is actually having to shut down his computers. He's obviously having to learn when to stop it, because people don't understand what's happening. Are we unleashing a monster? Elon Musk has just asked for regulation, and the nutcases at Facebook say, of course, just trust us, it'll be fine. And we know how much we can trust Facebook and Google. So it looks as if you're putting a lot of faith in machine learning, when we could be unleashing a monster, when software engineers don't actually understand what's happening.
Yes.
I have the luxury of working with machine learning type models in very confined situations where there's sort of no chance that it's going to sort of reach out and throttle me. So there are lots of situations where, like, things are well defined. So, like, developing a software program to predict whether a breast cancer screen is cancerous or not is a very well-contained problem. There's no risk that the robot...
And they're not going to take over the world.
Yeah, that's right. And you can monitor its performance. So you can actually say, well, sort of the computer missed a few. What's going on?
But decision-making, you start to find that they're making errors and you don't know how they're making errors.
Yeah, so that raises the question. And there needs to be some sort of way of at least tracking that. And if there are errors, then there's work to be done.
Tim?
Well, I actually don't know how you know that there's errors going on in this space, because the model just keeps producing. You keep, you know, the Amazon website where you get adverts because of a pattern that just keeps coming. When you get the advert, it's kind of self-perpetuating, isn't it? Sort of, you click on that, everyone likes it. Is it an error, or is it just driving my behaviour? That's part of the problem I think we're going to see as we try and use these techniques in more broad spaces.
But doesn't the use of big data demand that?
The thing that's evolved along with our ability to predict and build models is our ability to understand those models, I think, is sort of the first thing I'd say. Something that we do all the time is we sort of flex our input data set a little bit, and you actually see how the outputs are changing, and effectively that's a way of validating that the brain that you can't quite understand is doing something sensible on the inside. So I feel like that side of it is keeping pace at the moment. Maybe there'll be a point when it does not.
Can I just ask at the back, I'm still getting the questions from this morning. If we could refresh so that people's questions from now come through, that would be great. 0417-884-212 is the number to text your questions on. And I won't ask you any questions on mental health. I can see them going pale at the prospect that I might ask them some questions. Can you give me some specific examples of where micro-simulation, Hugh, has worked for you?
Yeah, so a lot of my work nowadays is actually in the social sector side. So the example I gave at the front was from the New Zealand welfare system, where we've been doing this stuff for 7 years or so. We do a similar valuation of the public housing system there. So the question is, well, how quickly do people move through public housing? And looking at the relative need of people who are waiting for housing relative to the people who are in housing. And we do it for a lot of corporates as well. So they're interested in understanding how their customers move through and before they sort of rip them off and they leave. So it's interesting that the areas where this sort of modelling has been done are the areas that doesn't carry a lot of actuarial baggage, if that makes sense, that people sort of starting from a clean slate have opted for something a bit more advanced.
So the question, Tim, is your actuarial baggage may not mean very much. It's just people not wanting to change. How fundamental could we go on things like, differential pricing and more accurate predictive models and so on, if we actually got rid of some of the baggage?
So that's the big societal question. I mean, as I tried to touch on at the end there, the way people think around insurance, which they think of cross-subsidising the average claims cost, not the unique claims cost. And so when you put the genetic test thing through and people say, if Tim Clark's got this gene, well, we can't sell him life insurance because he's going to die for certain, whereas other people who doesn't have the gene, he can get life insurance for very cheap. You almost have to do that, the way insurance works. But society doesn't really like that outcome. So it's a really difficult problem to go down to the individual pricing, because that's where we want to get to. That's where you need to get to if your competition goes that way. But your customers don't like it, so it's a challenging question for us.
Chris, there's a question here about what technological advance in the medical field will actually see rather than what the industry hypes us up on. So let's go forward 10 years. Michael Woolridge, former Minister for Healthcare, yep, said things don't happen much within 25 years, yep, in healthcare, not much less 10.
Yep.
Things happen much more slowly than you think.
I think that there's probably two things I could touch on. Number one is the telehealth or telemedicine aspect. I think that one of the barriers we have in regional and remote areas of Australia is how do we actually get healthcare to those people? I think there is a tangible outcome we can get around the sensor technology, and using that to as a surrogate for an examination based.
All part of remote health.
Correct, correct. I think the other.
And it should be said, I mean, people don't realise, in Townsville, there's one medical oncologist, cancer specialist, who doesn't leave his computer screen, Savi Savison, virtually. And basically does the cancer care for remote parts of that part of Queensland by telehealth. Mm-hmm. Queensland's probably got the most sophisticated system in the country.
Yeah. The other point I was thinking about was further driving evidence-based medicine and looking at outcome-based provision of care. Whilst that may not necessarily be medical technology, I think it is an area in healthcare that we need to start driving, not just in our space, but across healthcare in general, to start shining the light on outcomes from any particular practitioner's point of view and start getting value-based.
So we talked about that yesterday, which is really driving an outcomes-based reward system and so on. How do you change things to an outcomes basis?
Yeah, good question. Yeah.
Well, either of the two of you want to pick up on that? Because, I mean, it seems to me that if you really, that is the big disruptor. We can talk about all sorts of technologies, but the big disruptor in this industry and in healthcare would be paying for performance.
And performance as assessed by the patient. Are you happy?
Exactly.
Not just the medical. My hip works better now. Actually, am I happy with the outcome as well, which would be challenging for the profession.
That's true.
So technology you didn't talk about, but we alluded to yesterday, is patient-reported outcomes and patient-reported experiences for which there is validation now. Do you see that entering the insurance industry? Hugh?
No, I think it's getting there. So I think healthcare's always struggled with outcomes because defining sort of a solid objective outcome has been a challenge, and so it sort of has lagged other industries. So in Australia, there's, like, in the employment services, there are payments per outcome. So you're a provider only gets paid if you find a job for someone and they stay in it for 26 weeks. So other areas have progressed, and I think healthcare is slowly getting there. And it's not impossible.
I think probably the initial steps we need to take to start moving towards outcome-based payments is providing healthcare practitioners with de-identified data that shows their performance against their peers. I think that's one thing that we can do quite readily. I think the second...
It's low tech.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Once we actually start, recording the outcomes, it'll be low tech. The second aspect is my gut feel is in the initial phases, we'll need to incentivise, potentially, for an outcome, whether it be return to health or return to work, depending on what the option is. And theoretically, we may, in the initial phases, need to pay more to actually get that outcome, with the view that if it's in the workers' comp space, we may actually get the person back to health sooner and actually save the tail claim.
So just going to the future a little bit, at lunchtime today, I went to visit, so this comes to Hugh's point about the three-legged, well, I'll use the word stool, and I saw what I think was a technical innovation today. It's an institution probably nobody's heard of. It's called the Institute of Urban Indigenous Health. And you will not find a single corporate general practice in Australia as sophisticated as this. So they, and it's entirely, well, not entirely, but almost entirely funded through efficient use of Medicare payments. The guy who runs this, if I was Primary Health or Sonic, I would be pulling him out of there. Aboriginal, self-educated, one of the best businessmen I've seen in healthcare. So they have in their clinic an integrated data system. They can, at a press of a button, find out how every patient's going. They've got social care. They've got a gym attached. Not a single person is missed. They've got an incentive system called Deadly Choices, where they get an incentive. They get the latest designer Broncos shirt if they go for health checks. And
fax machines?
Sorry?
Fax machines?
Fax machines?
Yeah, no.
Well, the fax machine issue is a legal issue.
Yeah.
It is illegal to email medical information unless you do it to a secure email server. That's why they don't want to use fax machines. And but 19 clinics. So is most of the innovation going to be technical? That's really what I'm going to ask all of you, rather than technological.
I think so, is the answer. That we have sufficient technology that... it's all about implementation, so sort of making sure we design a system where the information flow is right and sort of pushing the right outcomes. And so if you are sort of providing that, then sort of everything else becomes a lot easier. So I think just the implementation side and actually sort of executing well is massive.
There's a question here for you, Tim. How do you think insurers and schemes can build enough trust for people to be comfortable with the machine learning and AI that the industry is using?
I think it's a hard one, but we're going to have to just open up your processes, your decision making, publish all your dispute ratios, all those sort of things through. You might even invite I like the idea of a citizen jury or some way you actually have customers sitting there running the algorithms, seeing how it works. You're just going to have to be as open and as transparent as you possibly can.
But doesn't that reduce your competitive advantage?
There's a risk of that, but I think it was interesting. At IAG's recent annual general meeting, the questions from the shareholders were all about How do you fix climate change? How do you fix Australian politics? It was nothing around the actual performance of the company and the expectation of
We're in deep duties of asking IAG for that answer, aren't we? With all due respect.
The chair lady did a wonderful job of kind of, well, that's a big question for us to solve. But the expectation of how far institutions have to go is part of building the trust that I think if they see you behaving in ethical ways in many other fields, maybe the machine learning and the AI, they say these people are acting in the right way outside that field, therefore we trust them with the machine learning. I mean, Google's thought of a great company, Do No Evil, and everyone, the young people love it, and yet I would say they're using all this stuff in ways that we don't like. So,
But Hugh, one of the issues with technological change and mass communication via online where you get global audiences is you only need the slightest change in trust for it to be a disaster for an organisation. I mean, it's fragile.
Yeah, very fragile is the answer. So, I mean, the New Zealand government over many years has sort of built up goodwill that they're actually trying to help people. They're trying to spend more money rather than cut. They're sort of genuinely trying to sort of improve long-term outcomes rather than sort of short-term cost-saving. I'm slightly conflicted in offering an opinion, but I think they've done that reasonably well.
I was going to say, you were just looking to next year's contract here, aren't
you? Yeah. But they've done it reasonably well, and I think largely they've sort of taken that trust. But as soon as you break that trust, as you say, everyone will see it as a cynical sort of exercise where you're trying to sort of window dress something evil. And that will actually kill the whole idea.
But it's pretty scary. It wouldn't, because you've got massive some organisations in this room are massive with lots of employees. It wouldn't take much, and it wouldn't necessarily be the fault of the organisation, just one rogue person or one innocent mistake, and you're staffed.
So there's a lot of governance that comes in there, I guess, and communication. Usually it's far harder to convince someone with a long explanation, but I think we live in a world where the right explanation is often a long explanation.
So, Chris, in this era where, we have a lot of technologies to increase flexibility, increase nimbleness and adaptiveness to complex situations, is governance going to stifle and slow us down and stop this great promise?
Don't know. It's going to be a factor, I think. So around, I suppose, the projection from that point of view, I think it will come back to that person-to-person care, basically, or person-to-human care. I don't know.
Tim, do you want to venture?
Oh, I think the rules and regulations we're operating today are not going to be able to keep up with the developments going forward, if you try and play by the rules exactly, I mean, Uber wouldn't have existed if it tried to play by the rules, would it? So, and yet we think, don't know about what you believe of the brand Uber is now, but certainly it's changed how mobility is happening in the world. So that's a good thing, isn't it?
It is a good thing, but people will say, well, it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission, but in your industry that's not true.
No.
Forgiveness is not easily won.
We have to ask Alan Fels before we do anything.
What is chairs of the Mental Health Commission? Another question here. What do you fear most in predictive analytics? What are the prime evils?
I guess a couple of answers. So one is that it is complex. Like by definition, sort of building complex models increases complexity. And so one classic area is, of course, like a lot of our models are effectively correlational except rather than causational. So when we say people who've been through the child protection system have higher risk of staying on welfare for a longer time, we're not actually saying that there's something wrong with the child protection system because it's producing all these poor outcomes. And so sort of just those obvious sort of observations that you can sort of draw the wrong conclusion if you're not sort of being careful is an issue. There's also, I think, a hint of, I guess, paternalism when I'm thinking about the government work in particular, that the government is sort of saying, well, these are all the problems in societies, now I understand them all really well, so I'm going to sort of design the programs and you're going to sort of get better as a result. I think there's sort of the risk that becomes a bit too paternalistic when, I mean, we're founded as a sort of a free society where personal responsibility and personal endeavour has consistently produced good outcomes, I guess.
So the moral hazard just sits there. One of the things you didn't talk about, Chris, and it could have an impact on almost every person in this room in terms of their personal healthcare, but also their cost base, and it is predictable, is that we're overproducing doctors by a massive amount. And there will probably be medical unemployment within 5 years, just like lawyers. Macquarie University is starting a medical school. Curtin University, the last state in West Australia, needs a new medical school at a hole in the head. And we're going to rue the day that we were overproducing. So what's the impact of this overproduction? Because it's likely to hugely increase costs. They're going to want to do stuff. In Melbourne, and we're not getting redistribution of doctors either. In Melbourne this year, there are 9 colorectal surgical fellows becoming consultants, not one job. And none of them are going to leave Melbourne. Not one job for colorectal surgeons. So, you know, where is this going to go? Because that is going to increase the cost base, because you've got all these doctors wanting something to do.
Exactly. One of the main drivers for graduation is actually getting an intern placement. And I think you may know the numbers better than I, but I think it's something like 10 to 20% of people who graduate can't actually get a hospital job in the following year, so hence they can't actually get their medical qualifications. A lot of these people then go back overseas and try and, you know, go from there. But it's an issue. I don't know how we'll resolve that.
But it's going to be, you know, managing one of the future issues, and it's not technological. Mm. And I asked it yesterday, and I'm going to ask it again today, because this could be a gee whiz discussion divorced from reality, is how the industry manages doctors better. Because you're the payers. And it strikes me that you shrink into a hole when it comes to this area. So what are you doing at iCare to control all these spinal surgeons making people worse with spinal surgery, for example? And that's only just one example. My favourite one.
I'm happy to take that one on, actually. So, look, I'll call it out. My view is that the spinal surgery is a symptom of the ecosystem that is workers' compensation. It's a symptom of what has happened beforehand. So if we call out back pain, every single person in this room will get back pain at least once in their life, probably a whole lot more. We know that regardless of what we do, people will get better within 4 to 6 weeks. If you do nothing, or you keep active, or you prescribe, you know, opioid analgesics, as soon as we ask for an X-ray or CT or MRI, we will find a problem, and it's unlikely that problem is related at all to that back pain. There is an expectation from the injured worker that they have to blame somebody, and that's that whole adversarial culture that we have in the system. So the injured worker then wants an outcome. They either want more drugs, or they want to be sent to a surgeon. Now, as soon as you send someone to a surgeon, I'll call it out now, surgeons are hammers and everything's a nail. You know, you're going to operate if you get sent to a surgeon. That leaves the GP in a difficult situation, because the injured worker wants to blame somebody for the pain that they got, that they probably would have got at home if it just happened to be on a Saturday versus a Friday. They want an outcome. We've done an MRI that's shown something that was probably not at all related to the back pain, and now we've gone down the surgical pathway. So we
and
know...
often before they've made a claim.
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So no doubt there's an issue with over-servicing and actually non-evidence-based or poorer outcomes with spinal surgery. But I think we actually need to address the entire system, as well as actually focusing on shining a light on surgeons' outcomes. And I know Ian Harris is doing a bit of work in that space right now, looking at spinal surgery, particularly in workers' comp.
So the question then is, this medical, but there's a review of medical benefit schedule payments, which is supposed to control all that, which should help, in theory, should help this industry, because this pre-claim behaviour, which delivers you a client or a worker or somebody who's had a road traffic accident with an adverse outcome, has already started by the time they make the phone call or write in the form. Will the MBS review make a difference?
In workers' comp?
Well, the fact that it might be harder to do an MRI scan on the back, or it might be harder to do something on the knee or what have you.
Yeah, I think from an investigation point of view, possibly, but from a management point of view, workers' comp, at least in New South Wales, sits outside of the MBA schedule and sits more at the AMA rates or above.
So we've got a general question here for the whole panel, which is, which single advancement are you most looking forward to? You're not allowed to say retirement.
I was thinking that too.
I want autonomous cars. Sort of all that time I waste driving. I don't enjoy driving. I'm not really a car person.
Right. So you're going to borrow Tim's Tesla. I was impressed that you had one.
I don't, actually. So
autonomous cars? Second, but I think they were hopefully referring to...
Something relevant.
Something to their industry.
I think it's just the efficiency in the medical practice or the health practitioner. You mentioned it. This whole idea of the data set that you need it's just not available to you as an individual. And you go to different... Your medical history is taken 15 times by 15 different people. That actually would be a...
So that, that probably is on the way.
Yeah, it's a very simple one, but it just annoys me.
I think for me it backs onto that, and that's that, I suppose, decision or clinical support tools, whether it be, you know, an evidence-based tool or an intelligence-based robot, pulling together all that information to support that history and that information to start steering people down an outcome. I think that would be great.
Can I ask, does the app have a word cloud? Is there a word cloud functionality? No. Okay.
I guess the other one I'm looking forward to is kind of wellness further into life. So actually keeping me healthy to 70s and 80s and being active for that whole period until you drop off, that's something I think...
But that's already happened.
Yeah, it has happened, but it can happen further as well, so can't it? So.
Yeah. I mean, the thing I struggle with most in my job is that we're making predictive models of the past, and so people say, well, what's the best out of A, B, and C? And I say, I don't know, because you haven't tried B or C yet. So I'm sort of excited, I think, in the future that there will be more appetite to try things and sort of, I guess, systematise the way you think about that decision-making process, and hopefully sort of collecting better data and sort of thinking about sort of randomised controlled trials across society a bit more generally, I guess.
So what predictions do you make around the workforce? So there's all this myth about aging. We're not aging. We're just living longer. You get sick for the 5 years before you die. That's always been the case. And, you know, after the war, the 5 years before you die was in your 60s. Then it got to 70s. And now it's in your 80s and 90s, depending on your social class and how well you're educated. So nothing's changed. There's no aging problem in Australia. It's just the 5 years before you die. And we've got this... The only problem is numbers. We've got this bulge of people coming through. So you're going to have more people in that 5 years before they die, and it's irrelevant when it is. However, you are, because they're living younger longer, you are going to have a workforce that's in the system for longer than that. What does predictive analytics tell us about that workforce? Is there anything about it we need to know? Or given that they're effectively living younger longer, it doesn't make a difference. They're the same kind of person anyway. So demographic change movement.
The nature of work's changing just as much, though. That's from things that you used to produce. I mean, it's such a small part of your expenditure now, the cost of your car, like books, all these things are now produced a lot cheaper than they did in the past. And we're taking out all this processing layer because we're all being able to do it straight through computers and all that sort of stuff. I'm not certain the workforce of tomorrow it won't be populated by aged people because we won't be able to change to programming computers or deep learning. It's going to be a totally new skill set, and so much can be done and scaled that actually does Australia need the workforce it has? What's it going to do? Mm-hmm. What do we need to produce?
So in fact, even though they want to work, they're not necessarily going to be tooled up for the new kind of work demands.
Correct.
Hugh?
Yeah. I mean, Amazon will always need people to deliver parcels, so...
Or drones.
Yeah.
And so with a PhD in statistics, you're looking forward to that prospect?
This is a big diversion, but sort of the first year after I finished my maths degree at university, I was walking out of the apartment where I was staying, and I was greeted by the garbage man who I'd been sitting next to the year before in fourth year mathematics. And so,
right.
So it can happen. I think one of the things, like the age 65 cutoff is a very artificial thing, and it'll be an artificial age 67 cutoff in the future, which isn't even more artificial because it's not a round number. I think what you'll...
I can just see, no, in a wise left-handed.
I think what you'll see in the future is sort of fuzziness added there. So I guess the idea of wellness is that sort of a 7-year-old and a 60-year-old, sort of the age isn't important, but it's more sort of what you're up to and sort of what you want to do with your life. And I think the recognition that work is actually a productive thing to be doing, even if you don't need to work. And I think there's a lot of more flexibility that'll come into sort of that sort of older period of people's life.
So final question, what's the biggest industry disruptor you can foresee on the horizon? Chris?
In the healthcare industry? I think it's going to be the information transfer.
Yeah, I think it'll probably be tech companies moving into healthcare and creating awkward questions in the way Uber has created awkward questions in transport, I think.
And Amazon does want to get into pharmacy, so that's the start. Tim?
So every business model is up for change. I mean, if you take motoring, we used to have a defined business model where someone made a car, someone sold the car, someone serviced the car, you went to the petrol station, whatever. Now, actually, the people who are playing around in autonomous vehicles, Telstra, want to be in there because they think with their platform they can run the whole thing, the whole mobility space.
God, those, help us.
Those out of the Philippines. Yeah. But there's every business model can be changed by the way we can aggregate and use logistics management through these tools. And it's just unbelievable what will happen. I don't know where it's going to go. I don't think any of us know where it's going to go, and that's the scary thing. So,
can you please join me in thanking our fantastic speaker?
Thank you.